Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Now it's time for The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. Good evening, Lawrence.
Good evening, Alex. You mentioned last night in our coverage the Atlantic article that was so powerful about the Georgia campaign and Herschel Walker in particular. You didn't get a chance to mention the author last night. You just concentrated on Caroline Randall Williams in your previous hour and the piece that she wrote. She actually sent the draft of it to me right before it was published in the Atlantic. And so she is going to join us during this hour.
Amazing.
Because as you say, it really is, it is a searing piece of writing, really powerful, about what the Georgia campaign meant to her and she believes other Black people.
Yeah, and I think it is. It really encapsulates the indignation, the anger, the hurt felt by Black Americans by the Walker candidacy, and it really holds the GOP's feet to the fire on an important issue that could destroy that party from within.
You know, when she told me she was writing something, it was the day before Election Day. And I thought, okay, kind of late, but she's a genius, literally, and I can't wait to see it. And you realize, oh, no, this is when it needed to be said. It was really on that final day.
And right now, as we're dealing with the sort of ashes of the Walker candidacy and what the implications are for the GOP, it's so timely. It's so resonant. So it's going to be a great segment to hear from her.
Caroline Randall Williams will get the last word on Herschel Walker here tonight. That's for sure.
It's a great show. Good
luck, Alex. Thank you. Well, we have major news tonight in both of the investigations being supervised by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, investigating possible criminal conduct by Donald Trump. And yesterday, for Defendant Trump, the first verdict returned by a jury in a criminal case was guilty, 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 guilty. Guilty, guilty, guilty. 9 guilty verdicts against the Trump Corporation, and then another 8 guilty verdicts against the Trump Payroll Corporation for a total of 17 guilty verdicts. The Trump Corporation was found guilty of 9 counts of fraud, conspiracy, tax fraud, and falsifying business records. The Trump Payroll Corporation was found guilty of 8 counts of fraud, conspiracy, tax fraud, and falsifying business records. In their final argument to the jury, prosecutors in Manhattan said that Donald Trump was personally responsible for the criminal scheme alleged and proved beyond a reasonable doubt by the Manhattan District Attorney. And after 10 hours of deliberation, less than an hour per count, the jury returned 17 guilty verdicts, guilty on all charges. Donald Trump was not personally a named criminal defendant in this case, but prosecutors convinced the jury that Donald Trump was part of the criminal conspiracy to commit those 19 crimes. The jury was convinced of that in less than 1 hour per crime of deliberation. Every prosecutor currently focused on Donald Trump, every state and federal prosecutor, from New York State to the state of Georgia to Special Prosecutor Jack Smith's federal investigations, every one of those prosecutors is taking note tonight of those 17 guilty verdicts and the speed of the jury's work in returning those 7 guilty verdicts beyond a reasonable doubt. Today, a new development emerged in the investigation of Donald Trump's possession of government documents, including classified documents. The Washington Post was the first to report today that Donald Trump's lawyers have handed over more classified documents that they found in Donald Trump's possession recently in a storage facility in Florida. The Washington Post reports lawyers for former President Donald Trump found at least two items marked classified after an outside team hired by Trump searched a storage unit in West Palm Beach, Florida, used by the former president, according to people familiar with the matter. Those items were immediately turned over to the FBI, according to those people. The New York Times reports that the search for those documents happened recently after, quote, Chief Judge Beryl A. Howell of Federal District Court in Washington, who oversees grand jury investigations, directed Mr. Trump's lawyers essentially to search more carefully for any remaining documents. The discovery of the documents at the storage unit maintained by the Federal General Services Administration came during a series of wider searches that were completed around Thanksgiving and conducted at Mr. Trump's golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, at Trump Tower in New York, and in a storage closet at Mar-a-Lago, according to two people familiar with the events. So Donald Trump's lawyers have just spent months arguing in court that they need a special master in that documents case to evaluate all the documents, because the documents taken by the FBI in a search warrant at his Florida residence this summer should never have been taken by the FBI and should be returned to Donald Trump immediately. That was Donald Trump's legal argument, which the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals rejected last week when it ordered the shutdown of the special master process. And here, those same lawyers, while they're making that argument, find some documents, two more documents labeled classified, and they immediately hand them over to the FBI. Immediately. Not to the special master, to the FBI. Today's reports indicate that the Trump lawyers invited the FBI to watch their search for more documents, but the FBI declined that invitation. In the other investigation supervised by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, subpoenas have been served to officials around the country in states including Michigan, Wisconsin, and, importantly, Arizona. The Washington Post broke the news this way. Special Counsel Jack Smith has sent grand jury subpoenas to local officials in Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin, three states that were central to President Donald Trump's failed plan to stay in power following the 2020 election, seeking any and all communications with Trump, his campaign, and a long list of aides and allies. One ally, who is already known to have been communicating with officials in Arizona, urging them to illegally overturn the outcome of the presidential election there, was the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. In June, the Washington Post reported Virginia Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, pressed 29 Republican state lawmakers in Arizona, 27 more than previously known, to set aside Joe Biden's popular vote victory and choose presidential electors, according to emails obtained by the Washington Post. Joining us now is Barry Burke, who served as special counsel to the White House, to the House Judiciary Committee during Donald Trump's first impeachment trial in the Senate, and chief impeachment counsel during Donald Trump's second impeachment trial. Also with us, Harry Lipman, former U.S. attorney and former deputy assistant attorney general. Harry Lipman, let me begin with you and this new revelation of suddenly, from a storage facility, here's two more classified documents. And the oddity of the way the handover of those documents seems to be in conflict with the Trump lawyers' arguments about the special master process.
Yeah, that's a really trenchant observation, I think, Lawrence. The way it came about is very odd. So they are in these somewhat secret proceedings before Judge Howell, as you say. And Judge Howell was exhorting them and then possibly ordering them, get these documents. That had been a suggestion before by the Florida Solicitor General, the sort of responsible lawyer who had joined Trump land. He had been rejected, his position, by all the hawks, and he'd been set to the side. Once Howell makes the order, they bring in another supposedly independent firm, and lo and behold, in this storage locker, which, by the way, had been the site of some of the documents already turned over. They find strewn with all kinds of, not just documents, but personal effects. These two incendiary. Holy cow. We got two more. Did we say we were all done? Oops. Sorry. And remember, back in May, they had attested, we've given you everything. So this is the what? Third, fourth, fifth time. It's not good.
So, Harry, the reports indicate that the Trump lawyers invited the FBI to watch what their hired firm was doing as a search. The FBI declined. Why would the FBI decline to watch that?
Yeah, no surprise. Barry would tell you the same thing. They'd always decline that invitation because they'd want in no way to have responsibility for what happens, to have the search be somehow subject to Fourth Amendment standards and a motion to suppress. That they want no part of it. If they're going to do it, they want their jackets on, their methods used, and they want to clear out everybody and do it their way.
Barry Burke, what are the Trump criminal defense lawyers thinking when they, first of all, commission this search and conduct it at that point in a proceeding where they are in other venues arguing that the government doesn't have any right to these documents?
They're hoping, well, please, please be no documents there, right? I mean, this is a lose-lose situation. They get no credit for turning them over because he's already been caught. Yet the lawyers are now going before judges and making representations. The other lawyers who did it before then are being investigated, as are almost every lawyer who's represented Trump in the past. So they have to do this. They know it's a problem. They're giving evidence that will be used against Trump. Now there'll be more inquiries. How did they get there? How do you explain this? And again, in the context, this was a very, very bad day for Donald Trump, because the nice thing about the jury verdict against the Trump Organization, it's a reminder for everyone that ultimately, if these cases are brought, it's a jury that's going to decide how they feel about it, how they feel about the elected leader of our nation putting his own personal interests above the security of our nation and doing things that anyone else would be prosecuted for. This is just one of those examples. But these documents coming again and again show that he treated it as though they were his own personal goods that he could do as he saw fit, regardless of how he might be harming the American people and our national security. And it's not going to get better. I think we're going to see more of this.
Barry, the criminal defense lawyers working on the documents case are not the same criminal defense lawyers who were defending the Trump business and in their failed defense of the Trump business in New York. But they're all watching this. All the Trump lawyers are watching this case. Do you think there was any surprise for any Trump lawyers just how quickly that that jury was able to unanimously find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt on every single count?
You know, trial lawyers can drink their own Kool-Aid and believe their arguments. I do think there's a bit of an urban myth that Donald Trump is somehow protected by Teflon, because he had not gone to jail. He had not been prosecuted. There have not been cases, despite him engaging in conduct for which anyone else would be prosecuted. And I think what this case does is it's a reminder, as I was starting to say, that jurors ultimately will decide in any case. 12 regular folks will decide. In this case, it was his organization. But when you look at the interfering with our elections, our sacred right, and you already saw the American people speak to that in the midterm elections. But if you think about that case being brought against Donald Trump and jurors looking at the overwhelming evidence that's only getting stronger with these subpoenas and the people closest to Donald Trump going into the grand jury without any protections of the executive privilege, that as that evidence builds, you think of another jury that will hear how the former president, while sitting in office, used his powers to try to prevent the will of the people and cause an attack on Congress. That is a great jury case for the prosecution. And today reminds us that now that we're getting closer to decisions about a case, ultimately, it does come down to those 12 people. So I really do think it puts the right lens on the ultimate question that's going to be asked soon, not can they bring a criminal case, because surely they're going to be able to bring and prove that case, should they? And part of that is, will a jury convict? And I think you saw evidence today that they will not hesitate, despite the fame of the organization or the person behind it, to do the right thing.
Harry Lipman, to the same point, inside Jack Smith's team. You got two teams, one investigating January 6th, another investigating the documents case. Federal prosecutors, put yourself back there in your old job as a federal prosecutor. You're on the Jack Smith team. How do you feel when those New York verdicts are unrelated as a matter of evidence? They're unrelated to what you're investigating. But how do you feel when those New York criminal verdicts come in?
Pretty much like Barry, who I think is ready to volunteer for Smith's team right now and do the closing argument. So look, at that trial itself, Trump became an issue because the defense came forward and said, you know, this is at the organization trial. Trump came they said, oh, Trump didn't know. And the other said they did. And the speed, to answer your question to Barry, you know, there was a tricky little legal point, and I thought it was fairly blinding speed. They plowed through it in 10 hours. And yes, I think it puts wind in the sails to say, when the attention is front and center on Trump and Trump only, with, of course, all the other evidence they're garnering in the grand jury of direct knowledge, especially from now Cipollone and Philbin, we're going to be able to show it. A jury is going to buy that Trump, of course, we know he did all the conduct. What about his state of mind? Yeah, they're going to see it. He knew and he concealed, and that's what we have to prove. So I think they're definitely have a spring in their step and are more ready to go forward as a result. And conversely, had it gone south, there would have been some much more nail biting in DOJ today and going forward.
Harry Litman and Barry Burke, thank you both very much for starting us off tonight.
Thanks, Barry.
Really appreciate it. Thank you. Coming up, the Supreme Court heard arguments today on a case that could end democracy in America and make state legislatures the most powerful governing entity in the country. Our frequent guest, Neil Katyal, spoke at the Supreme Court today in defense of democracy. That's next.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
In what may be the most important case about the processes of democracy ever considered by the United States Supreme Court, the court heard oral arguments today about this clause of the Constitution. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may, at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. Republican state legislators in North Carolina have appealed a case to the Supreme Court in which the state Supreme Court of North Carolina overturned the legislature's congressional redistricting plan. Republicans are arguing that no state court has the power to do that because the Constitution grants the power exclusively to state legislatures. Their theory of the case is an obscure fringe legal notion, not even justifying the phrase legal theory, called the independent state legislature doctrine. Here is some of what Justice Elena Kagan had to say.
I'd like to step back a bit and just, think about consequences, because this is a theory with big consequences. I think what might strike a person is that this is a proposal that gets rid of the normal checks and balances on the way big governmental decisions are made in this country. And you might think that it gets rid of all those checks and balances at exactly the time when they are needed most, because legislators, we all know, have their own self-interest. They want to get reelected. And so there are countless times when they have incentives to suppress votes, to dilute votes, to negate votes, to prevent voters from having true access and true opportunity to engage the political process.
Neil Katyal, who presented a masterclass today in how to argue a case in the Supreme Court, rose in opposition to the North Carolina legislature. And here is how he rocketed out of the gate with his very first words to the court.
For 233 years, states have not read the Elections Clause the way you just heard. There are two reasons to affirm. One is that when enacting legislation, there's no such thing as an independent state legislature. The other is that North Carolina statutes authorize what the North Carolina court did. I'll focus on the first. Petitioner's idea that state legislatures created by state constitutions are independent of them is wrong. It is rejected by the Articles of Confederation, rejected by the early state constitutions, rejected by the founding practice, especially in New York, where judges vetoed federal election bills. It's also rejected by this court in cases such as Smiley and Hildebrandt.
Joining us now, Janae Nelson, President and Director, Counsel of the Legal Defense Fund, and Melissa Murray, Professor of Law at New York University and an MSNBC legal analyst. Professor Murray, let me begin with you and your reaction to what you heard in court today. It's just an open mic, no specific question. I wouldn't presume that. Go ahead.
Well, this is the kind of question I like most, Lawrence. So this was a rollicking argument from start to finish. As you say, the independent state legislature theory really doesn't even deserve the moniker of theory. It really is more like fan fiction. And the fans here are the Republican legislators in various state houses across the country who would love to be able to further consolidate their power by being freed from the constraints of having state courts use state constitutions to constrain them or restrain them for the purpose of having free and fair elections. So what we heard here today, as Justice Kagan said, is a monumental theory that will have enormous consequences if this court chooses to credit it. And it did seem as though there were at least three people on this court who were enamored of this theory slash fan fiction. And the real question is, can they get two others within that conservative bloc to join them for a five-person majority?
Janae Nelson, what were the highlights that you heard today?
Oh, there were many. One of them that I'll choose is what Justice Kagan asked. It's what you put up on the screen before we started, and that is, what are the consequences? And I think it's very easy to get caught up in the really lofty title of this theory that you mentioned, the independent state legislature theory. But what's really at stake here is a power stripping from state courts. For decades, for 233 years, as Neil Katyal pointed out, we've understood that state legislatures are checked by state courts. They have to operate within the bounds of the law and within the bounds of state constitutions in particular. And state courts have been the check to ensure that state legislatures are not running amok, are not becoming lawless political entities. And that reins them in and checks the balance of power that we all expect to govern our elections. We know the Constitution allows state legislatures to determine this time, place, and manner, but they can't just do that without any check at all. And that's ultimately what this theory would require.
Professor Murray, let's listen to what Neil Katyal had to say about what he called, I believe this phrase was, the blast radius of this.
The blast radius from their theory would sow elections chaos, forcing a confusing two-track system with one set of rules for federal elections and another for state ones. The blast radius, by their theory, starts at the size extra large. It starts with invalidating 50 different state constitutions today. Elections clauses are in 27. All states have equal protection clauses, speech clauses, assembly clauses. 30 of them guarantee the right to a secret ballot.
And with all of that, I felt like that was almost just the tip of what was possible here, that it just felt like there was an unlimited set of implications here.
I think that's exactly right, Lawrence. Not only would this eliminate all of those provisions for free and fair elections that appear in state-level constitutions, it actually has the impact of fundamentally altering the basic rudimentary election practices that we know, like whether or not you can have a polling place in X location. All of those things would be subject to the state legislature as opposed to a board of elections or any other kind of entity that currently regulates elections. And perhaps most problematically, this theory of the independent state legislature, if taken to its logical conclusion, is not constrained or limited to just this elections clause of Article 1. It could also be incorporated into Article 2's elections clause, and that deals with the electors in the Electoral College. And that's the theory that essentially those Trump allies, John Eastman, et cetera, were trumping and trumpeting during the 2020 election. This idea that if the state legislature does not approve of the choice of the voters in that state, under this theory, they would be authorized to provide their own slate of electors. So taken to its logical conclusion, it's not the issue in this case, but if taken to its logical conclusion, this would extend to that as well.
Yeah, Jeanette Nelson, there was what I considered panic talk around September of 2020 about the Pennsylvania legislature maybe just seizing control of the Electoral College vote in Pennsylvania and just declaring it to be a certain number. But I kept saying that's impossible because the legislature has delegated the authority, in effect, to choose the electors to the voters, and they would have to pass a new law that a Democratic governor would have to sign into law, which isn't going to happen. And so it was all then impossible. This could make it possible.
Yes, and not only could it infect state elections, this will ultimately have a significant impact on Congress, on the way we are represented across the country. If you look at the underlying facts in the North Carolina case itself, it was a rank partisan gerrymander. The state is roughly 50-50 in terms of support for Democrats and Republicans. But if you look at the congressional map that was being challenged in North Carolina, 10 of the districts easily would elect a Republican representative. We're a nonpartisan organization, but we can see quite plainly that that is a partisan gerrymander. And it was just less than 3 years ago that the court said, the Supreme Court, that it could not intercede in partisan gerrymandering. In Rucho versus Common Clause, it said this is a matter for states and state courts. Here, the state of North Carolina does exactly what the Supreme Court said it should be doing. And the Supreme Court decides to take up this case and say that perhaps, and we hope that it won't go this far, that perhaps state courts have no check on state legislatures. And this will be the undoing of our representative bodies in Congress, the House, and this, and it will have just, I think, enormous consequences. And we will not be able to put the genie back in the bottle.
Jeanette Nelson and Professor Melissa Murray, thank you both very much for joining our discussion tonight.
Yeah. Thank you, Lawrence.
Coming up, Senate Democrats have a new hero. The now reelected Senator Raphael Warnock returned to the Senate today. We will be joined next by Caroline Randall Williams, whose essay about the Georgia Senate campaign in the Atlantic is titled "Herschel Walker is an American Tragedy." That's next.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
There is nothing more rare than a senator being regarded as a hero by other senators. But today, Washington saw the return of a conquering hero, the likes of which the Senate has not seen before. Senator Raphael Warnock's re-election last night in Georgia changed the lives of 50 other Democrats in the United States Senate from members of a technical majority to members of an actually functional majority, a majority that actually has the real powers of a Senate majority for the first time. When the Senate was stuck at 50-50 for the last 2 years, each party had the same number of senators on committees, so committees could be deadlocked in tie votes constantly. Now the Democrats will have a one-vote majority on all committees, which will speed up committee processes significantly, especially the confirmation of federal judges, for which Joe Biden has already set a record. Senator Warnock's re-election victory marks the first time since 1934 that not a single incumbent senator in the president's party lost a re-election campaign in the president's first midterm election. Republican Senator Mitt Romney blames Donald Trump for that.
President Trump lost again, and I know a lot of people in our party love the president, former president, but he's, if you will, the kiss of death for somebody who wants to win a general election. And at some point, we've got to move on.
Our next guest, Caroline Randall Williams, published an essay in The Atlantic yesterday on Election Day titled, "Herschel Walker is an American Tragedy." She wrote, Walker's candidacy is, quote, a fundamental assault by the Republican Party on the dignity of Black Americans. Joining us now is award-winning poet and author Caroline Randall Williams. She is writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it. Two things. Why did you wait till the last day of the Senate campaign to compose your feelings this way about what you were watching? And what was it feeling like for you last night as you saw the election returns come in?
I wish I could say that it was a matter of waiting, Lawrence. And I was listening to, you know, your exchange with Alex before, and it was a little late, but I find that duress is sort of the author of inspiration in a lot of ways. And I was just feeling this pressure of catastrophe, and it pushed the article out. So I'm classic poet moment in that. But what was happening when I was watching the election and watching the brilliant Steve Kornacki do all of his brilliant labors on television, I was thinking, I've never actually felt quite so sick, because, you know, I think 50% of the vote had come in and Walker was winning. And I thought, well, I'm glad I said it before it happened, because I think I wrote the article thinking it might not come out on the day of the election, but we need to talk about this, whoever wins, because what's happened is a great indignity. And it's an indignity to the past legacy of whatever Herschel Walker's accomplishments might have been. And it's indignity for Black people to have to watch as though just picking a candidate by race might level the playing field in some way that we know isn't right.
Yeah, it wasn't really Herschel Walker's idea to run for Senate. Donald Trump recruited him. They went out there and recruited him into doing this. What does that dynamic mean in this story?
To me, it means that the Republican Party has become very cynical and very strategic, and I hope very wrong-minded about how race works in this country, because essentially they put two Black men, they pitted them against one another and said, now I dare you to call us racist. I dare you to call us racist when our candidate is Black too. As though competence, dignity, decency, political, professional acumen had nothing to do with it. Being an excellent athlete has nothing to do with being an excellent politician. Being an excellent pastor very much can have a great deal to do with your capacity to engage with the public and speak competently and think ethically about matters of state. And so I think it was sort of astonishing that the Republicans did this blatant, strange Emperor's New Clothes minstrelsy performance
with Walker's candidacy that is an assault to our intelligence. And also this weird gaslighting that I just said, I can't stand for it. I can't watch this election come and go and not say what we're all thinking and seeing.
What was the gaslighting element of it? How would you describe the gaslighting element of it?
I would describe the gaslighting. So the commentary that I've received since I published the article, people saying, oh, just because you don't agree with Walker's position, or you don't hold Walker's values, or you think that a black man can't think for himself and he can't choose and take this position. And so you're just myopic in your opinion. And this is the problem with black Democrats. Like, I've gotten so much feedback like that. And I think that that's gaslighting to me, because I am not saying that there's no such thing as a sane black Republican. I've listened to Colin Powell speak on television. I admire Michael Steele for his backbone and his willingness to try and figure out how to make his beliefs work within this wild universe that the party that he worked within has wrought. I love my own father, for example. There are such things as decent black Republicans, or there once were. And there's some kind of gaslighting when you're saying, oh, because you're calling out the one, that means you don't believe that it's a thing that can exist. And no, I don't believe that Herschel Walker is a decent anything, except for a football player. And I don't really know anything about football, to be honest.
Well, you know an awful lot more that you were teaching us in that piece. Caroline Randall Williams, her brilliant article is in The Atlantic. It's a must read. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you. Coming up today, Vladimir Putin said that the risk of nuclear war is increasing. Also today, Ukraine's President Zelensky was named Time's Person of the Year. That's next.
Is it the beginning of the end of the war? Of course, you see our strong army. We are step by step coming to our country, to all the temporary occupied territories. All this victory is possible when all the world is around Ukraine.
Today, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was named Time magazine's Person of the Year, an honor that recognized not only his leadership, but also the spirit of Ukraine and its people. Joining us now is Simon Schuster, senior correspondent for Time magazine, who spent 9 months reporting on President Zelensky for this year's Person of the Year cover story. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. As you know, so many people around the world see him as a Winston Churchill-like figure in the way that Winston Churchill was fighting a lonely war for that first couple of years of World War II, doing so bravely in the line of fire while London was being bombed. What do you see when you're up close with President Zelensky?
I think that comparison does come to mind. It's interesting that when I raised that idea with President Zelensky, during our interview for this piece, one of the interviews that we did, I asked him, you know, what do you make of all these people who compare you to Winston Churchill? He didn't like that very much. He made it clear, for one thing, that he wasn't so keen on Churchill's legacy as an imperialist, as a supporter of the British Empire. Zelensky, of course, is fighting the Russian Empire or its revival. So he didn't like that so much. And he shifted. He said he preferred to be associated with artists and comedians, comic actors like Charlie Chaplin, who were of Churchill's era, but used a different form of influence to fight fascism, the influence of humor, the influence of their popularity among people, their ability to reach people through the arts, through communication, through words.
To go back to the Churchill example, Winston Churchill did not have anything resembling a strategy for victory for the first year of World War II. It was nothing other than a strategy of survival. Can we somehow survive not being completely overrun by Germany? Where is President Zelensky strategically? Is this at a survival stage, or is this something more than survival?
I think we're well past the point of just trying to survive. I think Ukraine, President Zelensky, his military,
they feel like they have the momentum. I think the facts on the ground, on the battlefield, bear that out. They are in no mood to plea for peace or push ahead with some kind of peace negotiations, that certainly none that would involve ceding territory and making concessions to the Russians. They are intent on pushing the Russians back as far as they can. I mean, the main part of the story for Person of the Year involved me traveling with President Zelensky to the liberated city of Kherson, the biggest city, the most strategic and important city the Russians seized at the beginning of the invasion. Now the Ukrainians have it back. And I think they want to continue in that frame, in that dimension of the conflict, and not yet sit down to negotiations.
Simon Schuster, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Tonight's Last Word is next. I began my workday today 15 hours ago on Morning Joe, where my friend Willie Geist asked me how the Kind Fund began.
A friend of mine in Boston who runs a school there went to Malawi, Meg Campbell. She, her niece was a doctor there. She was just going to visit her niece, and she went around to schools and she said to them, "What do you need?" And they didn't say pencils, and they just immediately said chairs. All they said was chairs. They wanted kids to get off the floor. Mm. They weren't even saying desks. Could you give them something to write on? Just chairs. And I heard that. I remember thinking, well, we could. Couldn't we do something about that? I mean, at some small scale, like for one school. Turns out very difficult. Getting the manufacturing capacity in Malawi was extremely difficult. No one was making them at the time. I found one guy with a hardware store in the capital city who actually made one student's desk, the kind that you see right there, hoping that someday the Ministry of Education would want to try to put desks in schools on a larger level. And I asked him, "Can you make me 30 of those this week and we can deliver them to the school down the street?" And he said, "Sure, I can do it in 48 hours.
No.
I said, "How are you going to do that?" He said, "I'm going to walk out on the street and I'm going to find carpenters and welders and painters who are all unemployed. They're trained and unemployed. I'm going to put them on 3 8-hour shifts, 24 hours a day. I will have these for you in 48 hours.
Wow.
And on Friday morning, we did it.
And in the 12 years since then, the man running that hardware store, Motion Musa, is now running a large factory employing dozens of workers in Malawi who have made thousands of desks that have been used by over 1 million children in Malawi. And there are other factories around Malawi now that are also building desks for us and employing dozens and dozens more workers. And we have added a scholarship program for girls to attend high school in Malawi, where public high school is not free. And the girls' graduation rate is half the boys' graduation rate. Monday night, you heard from Faith Namanguyo telling us how important her scholarship is to her after her father died when she was in fourth grade and her family could not afford high school tuition. Kristen tweeted, "Loved Faith on The Last Word tonight. I donated enough to buy 12 desks today. It felt better than anything else I've purchased this holiday season." I know that feeling, Kristen. It feels even better than anything else that I do for Christmas, too. Leslie Kogan tweeted, "I'm watching your show tonight and just fell in love with Faith as I fell in love with Joyce many years ago. I still recall her little by little poem and have been donating scholarships to the Kind Fund every year." In Joyce Chazale's first appearance on this program as a high school student in 2016, she told me that she wanted to be a doctor and a poet. And then she spontaneously recited a poem that she wrote about her own determination, which she called Little by Little. Joyce Chazale is now a medical student in Malawi in medical school, thanks to your kindness that enabled her to complete high school. You can contribute any amount at lastworddesks.msnbc.com in the name of anyone on your holiday gift list, and UNICEF will send them an acknowledgement of your gift. "Dig What I Say" tweeted, "I just watched Faith, and she is one amazing young lady. How can we not support her and her peers? I jumped out of bed and donated a scholarship because my granddaughter will never face her hurdles, and yet Faith is just as deserving as my Pickles. Well, Pickles, you've got a pretty great grandfather there. Marsh Watching tweeted, extra happy to discover many direct economic and employment benefits this provides the whole community. Jazz Bomb tweeted, I hope the young lady we saw tonight realizes her dream. Faith Namangio is closer to her dream tonight, thanks to all of you. That is tonight's last word.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.